everyone. You're very welcome along to another edition of the Greg Hughes podcast. And this week, I'm joined by a true icon of Irish traditional music, founding member of Alton, fiddler and singer Raidhne Mooney. We take a deep dive into her remarkable life and career, tracing the journey from growing up in a rich musical home in Gweedore to touring world stages, including playing to sold-out audiences in Japan and beyond. Mairead opens up about the realities of life on the road, balancing an international touring schedule with parenting and what continues to inspire her work after decades at the forefront of traditional music. Plus, the episode features exclusive live musical performances recorded right during our conversation. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. I began by asking Raidhne Mooney what life was like in Gweedore. She was born, of course, in the beautiful part of West Donegal in 1959, and perhaps I thought it wasn't quite as advanced as it was, and Mairead very soon put me right. Born in West Donegal in 1959, a very different time in Ireland. And not because so much time has passed, but because, you know, a lot of innovation took a while to arrive here. Mm-hmm. And we sort of had a different way of doing things, and life was very different. What was life for you as a youngster in Gweedore?
Yeah, well, Gweedore was quite advanced in a way. You know, my father encouraged me to, you know, I was into art and I was into music and I wasn't really into the academics at all because I was left-handed. So one of the teachers decided I was a lost cause. So that made me more creative again. And Francie loved that because he was a teacher in the school. But, you know, he made sure that he actually encouraged me to use both hands. So I was right-handed. So I was ambidextrous for a wee while until you know, it got rid of the teacher kind of imposing their attitude on me. But then it made me as well, there was a lot of drama being done. My father wrote drama and pantomimes. I told you before, he started the pantomime in Remelton.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was when he went home then, Aisteoirí Gweedore, which were the Gweedore actors, they said, well, you started one in Remelton, maybe you'll do one here. So he started writing pantomimes in Gweedore as well. And that made us all part of the, you know, being the acting, art, yeah. You know, yeah. And it was all fun. So that was happening. And then the industrial estate was opening up. So there was a lot of work coming in and, you know, the place was blooming and people were returning home from.
Yeah, so it was a real positive vibe you were born
there
into.
It was yeah. Great, and things were expanding, and there was a lot of. I remember an English musician coming through, Ian Stevenson. He was a great musician, and he said, "This is a very Gweedore has a very continental feel." He thought, you know, he thought there was a lot of development happening, and the people were speaking Irish, but they were very modern. Like everybody, like we had everything that anybody in London had as well, you know, as regards gadgets or, you know, the whatever LPs were coming out or whatever. So we were tuned into Radio Luxembourg. And all of that.
All
as
the
well.
Stuff you're talking took about 1980 to get to South Donegal, so I don't know. I don't know how you were getting it into the West, but
no.
It sounds amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, and we didn't see anything. We didn't see the language or where we were situated as a pediment, against us. So and we were very, like, everyone was encouraged to go to third level college. All my friends went to third level. You know, I thought it was a very lovely upbringing,
you know. And encouragement. And it sounds like, you know, things were you know, harnessed and encouraged and brought forward and all
and,
that
and,
type of
you
stuff.
Know, self-development was also encouraged. And, you know, it was modern. You know, we were really into David Bowie and all this stuff, like the Rolling Stones and everything. Anything that was happening in London, we were really into it.
And because you were sort of in the traditional music set as well as everything else, that wasn't frowned on at all, was it?
Oh, yes, it was.
These external influences.
We were I was looked at as an odd
poisoning your mind.
No, it's at school, you know, I just wouldn't tell anybody I played the fiddle, and then sometimes the teachers would be laughing, you know, Strad and today, Strad, you know. So I remember cornering a young teacher one night, and I said, he was at the disco we were all at, and I said, did you call me Strad the other day? And we were laughing. So he laughed his head off, you know. He said, well, sure, you played the fiddle, you know. So
you favoured your left hand, and he says you're ambidextrous. Yeah. Just a curiosity, because you meet an awful lot of people in the arts. Are left-handed people generally more creative, or is that? Because I'd be watching films and often the actors be writing and seem to favour the left hand, and then you see musicians and stuff. Yeah, is there anything to that, no?
Well, I don't know. Like, I just read all about it as well, and they say it's kind of you're using the other side of your brain, which is the creative side. That's what they say. I wish I was more creative.
You don't know, right?
But I do play the fiddle with my right hand, and so I'm upside down. My father was a footballer as well, so but he was a left-footed, but he wrote with his right hand.
Yes.
So he said his left side was also very dominant.
I do that. I do some left, some right. Yeah. It's really quite peculiar. I think it's down to my eyes. I don't know if your dad had different vision in his eyes, but I have never checked it out. But I think it could have something to do with that.
I think it's to do with your brain.
Is it?
Oh, okay. Definitely your brain.
Well, a confirmation, I have one, which
so
is
so you
fantastic.
Must be very, very creative.
Influences, obviously. I mean, you were born into music. Is that fair to say? You're born into sort of the arts, more generally speaking. So a lot of this, to come to pass, was inevitable. The level to which you could do it, that's never inevitable, because that requires skill and hard work and passion and everything. But you were always going to be involved in that space, weren't you?
Well, like, I went on to do teaching. So I thought, like, the music was always going to be there as enjoyment and self-expression and all of that. But then when Frankie, my late husband, and I were teaching, like, this government brought in this, they had too many teachers trained and there wasn't enough.
Wow.
So they said, we'll bring in a scheme where you can take a year off and your job is guaranteed. So anything like that, like, and when you're only 22 years old, you say, yes, I'd like to travel a bit. And so that's how it all started.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. How times have changed.
But
we
it was so
incentivizing teachers to take a sabbatical, effectively.
It was great. And the security of it was fantastic, because it meant you weren't leaving your job, but you could try out something else.
But, you know, you have influenced and have been influenced throughout your entire life. And I know to this day continues. But up until that point, though, you were being influenced and mentored and what have you musically, weren't you?
Like, I was totally engrossed in music, if you know what I mean. It was like my daily sustenance, you know. Music was just part of breathing and eating. So, and it will always be, no matter what. But, it just gave us a chance to go out there and check to see if we could make this a living. And if not, we'd like to see the world anyway. So it was this great guarantee. And I think it was the best education I ever got.
Yeah. Talk to me about your early meeting with Frankie and how that developed.
Well, that was it was very innocent. I was about 15 and he had just started college in Queen's University. And he came in the door and, like, he always had a baby face. So I thought he was around my age, but he was 18 or 19. And I just totally fancied him. Like, I mean, how silly am I at 16?
It's lovely. I know.
So I was playing
tunes. Because it's pure innocent as
well,
isn't
it was it? So innocent. But we really didn't get a chance to, you know, talk or go out together until the summer. Like, we kind of noticed each other, but, you know, there was...
And he was far away and you were at home. You were corresponding.
Oh, he was in Belfast. So we were pen friends. And then in the summer, and he didn't play anything at that stage, but he started then his big thing. Every year he'd go to see Rory Gallagher in Belfast, and he came to Donegal for the summer. And he started frequenting places in Belfast where you could hear traditional music. And then he met friends of mine that used to come to Gidor a lot. And they said, you better start learning an instrument. So he started learning the whistle and then the flute. And I knew he liked me then because he gave up a Rory Gallagher gig to come and see me.
Well, that was the test. Yeah. And was it love at first sight for you?
Oh, definitely.
It might be a different emotion to love, but you...
No, there's something in my head said, I'm going to marry him.
Wow.
Why? I don't know where, like, the more I think about it, I say, where was my head? Romantic.
And is there a piece of music that you associate with that time of your life? Do you do that? You know how we have sights and sounds? Is there a piece?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really know. When was that? I was very
late
young.
Late 70s.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, David Bowie's, what was the one? The one he was alien.
Starman?
Yeah, Starman. Yeah. That was the one. I loved that at that time. Because my brother was the one that was buying the LPs, and I was...
I thought you were going to say Absolute Beginners. That sounds like a track for...
Yeah, that's a good
track for Love Young. So he became really proficient, obviously, on the whistle and flute. I'm curious. Are you can't learn to be brilliant at something, can you? Like a musical instrument. There has to be something...
Well, you have to
put a hidden talent in there.
Oh, yeah.
Though,
well, he was obviously very musical. But you have to put the time in. Mm. You know, they say you have to put, 10,000 hours into learning an instrument, or maybe more than that, 100,000 hours. But he did put an awful lot of time into his music. But what I noticed about Frankie, and he made me aware of this, he was into finesse, you know, the end of the note, or, you know, the spaces and... You know, that was
that would have been coming probably from being a fan of the music.
Yes.
But obviously on a slightly deeper level than I might be, for an example of what
but
sounds
it,
right.
It was, and... Yeah, he was into finesse. And, you know, to me, I would just play a tune. But I never actually thought about all these other things that happen within the note.
Mm.
You know, so this is a new thing for me. So to me, I was learning a lot. He was saying to that he learned it from me, but I was learning so much from him as well, you know, all these other ideas coming in.
And at what stage then did you sort of form something together? I don't mean a relationship now, but musically. Because there was an early incarnation of a band, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, when I went to college then in Dublin, you see, when I was about 17, invited to play in the folk clubs there right away, because I'd be out in the sessions and somebody said, would you play in the tradition club down the road? And I said, yeah, you'll get a few pounds and keep you going. So Frankie and I started playing in the tradition club in Capel Street, which all the traditional musicians used to go. And you'd go in there, you might meet Seamus Ennis, who is one of the top collectors of traditional music, and he'd be there at the bar, or Liam O'Flynn or Don Lunny, or, you know, all these big names, they'd all be there. So it was a very hard place to play tunes and sing songs in front of, but it was a great grounding. And then you'd go other weeks and there'd be like all your heroes were singing or playing music. And I remember one night being there.
Did you feel like a bit, sorry before you said it, was there a bit of imposter syndrome, or did you feel a part of this, you know?
Well, I wanted to be a part of it, but I felt very, you know, I'm not worthy to be here, you know.
Really?
Oh yeah, that's how I remember Jackson Browne arriving in one night. And he was doing a big gig in the stadium, but he had a night off and he just wanted to hear real music. And we were all saying, there's Jackson Browne there, you know, mad. And like that happened a few times where well-known people would just arrive into this small, small, dirty old place on Cable Street and upstairs and sit and listen to the music. Mm. And it was great. It was encouraging too, that people that you looked up to from another genre of music would come and listen to traditional Irish music.
But it obviously had a fantastic reputation. It might not have the best aesthetics as you describe it, but it obviously was seen as a hotbed of talent.
Oh yeah, that's where you'd go to hear the music, the real stuff, the real bar, the raw bar, as they'd say. But like I that happened to me as well when I went to New York to listen to jazz. I wanted to hear the best jazz, and you go into these little danky dinky little places, you know, where, to hear jazz being played by the best musicians in New York. So like it makes sense, you know, you don't really care what their surroundings are like as long as you hear the good music.
Do you know, if you go to the likes of, and I don't want to sort of look down on anyone, and we'll pick up your career in a moment, but I was down in Dublin recently, and I was trying to, and it's because I don't know, but there's this presentation of our music, and even to some extent people putting on, you know, Arabagara accents and stuff. Are there still places like that which you describe nowadays? Because unfortunately, most of the people that visit here, they get some sort of a sanitized commercial version of our culture, really.
Yeah, they get a kind of a diluted river dance come Paddy come, you know. You know, what was that film that they did years ago? Like with all the leprechauns and everything, they get a diluted version of that. Like a lot of young musicians are making a lot of money around the Temple Bar area, putting on a show. But if you really want to hear the right music, there are a few pubs in Dublin that I would go to, the Cobblestones or the there's the Piper's Rest, and you know, where you hear the music in its raw state without the big you know, the big fanfare.
Yeah.
And there's no chat. It's just play music. And you might be lucky, you might hear the best music. You know, I've been to a few of these sessions recently and they're just amazing. Mm. Loads of young musicians. But my favorite type of session is about 4 or 5 people playing, not 100 people playing. Mm.
Yeah,
I'm not into it being 20 musicians because you can't talk to them. Part of the session is to chat and where did you get that tune? And oh, would you play it again till I learn it? Or, you know, that's to me the best part of the session.
Yeah, I'd say it's amazing. I feel so jealous not to be in this set.
Yeah.
So at what point then did you and your brother and Frankie form a band?
Well, it was, you know, it was out of demand, really. You know, people would say, would you come and play here? Would you come and play there? And there was a, a competition up in the north, and we formed a band with a friend of ours from Newry as well, Donal O'Hanlon, and Garage, my brother, on the guitar, and Frankie and I. And we won this up in County Down, and it was oh, we felt great, you know. We said, "Ooh, we won, you know, this folk competition." And then before that, we won the Letterkenny Folk Festival.
That's right, yes.
Oh, that's when I was,
I
really
that's
young.
What you're about to reference.
Oh, no,
it.
No.
I thought that
actually
was the big time.
No, yeah, well, there was more than Garrett there. Yeah. There was my cousin Margaret Denny, Margaret Gallagher on Baran, and there was another Belfast man, Frankie McAlla. He used to play the accordion in Hoodie Bugs all summer long. Actually, Frankie Kennedy wasn't there at all. And myself and Terry McIntyre from Ballyshannon, who worked in the, he was a manager in the industrial estate, and he played the fiddle, and he still plays the fiddle. And we had a great night, and we got 500.
That was in Letterkenny.
I know, it was fabulous. We felt wonderful, and we got a record deal out of it, which was fantastic.
Yes.
That the record never came out.
Why not?
I don't know.
Did you play regularly together, or did you just gather up musicians for this performance?
Well, we played in sessions in Hootie Bugs, really. You know, Patrick Hootie Bug was part of it as well. So, like, it was just the crowd that used to play sessions in Hooties. But we felt great. We went back to Hootie Bugs that night and bought drinks all around us.
Fantastic.
I think we spent the €500 and
that night. Well, 500 is considerable.
Oh, that was a lot that time. No, we kept. Some people said, oh, I'll be able to buy shoes now. So.
Yeah. Ragarn was that band then that you did with Frankie then, isn't it? Is
yeah, Ragarn, yeah.
And so, was Enya in that for a time as well?
No, she came later when we were actually making our first album for Gaelin. And Nicky Ryan, who died just last year. He was Enya's manager and producer. So I had met him through Clannad many, many years before that. And he says, if you are ever making an album, I want to engineered and produced it.
Yes.
So when we were asked by Gaylene to make the album, soon after we were married, I think it must have been 81. Don't ever ask me the dates.
Sadly,
of these things.
I have all the dates here, but...
You remind me of the Japanese.
I know, you have an intense interest in you and your life. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway,
it was 83, the first album.
So anyway, so Nikki came in and we were making this album, and it was mostly kind of unaccompanied, and I had my brother playing, and then Kieran Corn, who ended up in Altan, and it was going really well, and I had a song, and I said I'd really love a nice low drone under this, and he says, sure, I'll get Enya. And I said, oh, would you mind coming in? So Enya came in. She wasn't well known at all at this stage, but she was working on her music. And I was saying, I was really thanking her. And we wanted to pay her. She wouldn't take a penny because we're neighbors. We're neighbors. Why would I do that? Like we were so delighted that she, and she did a great job with it. So so she played on that Call of Dewey, which is the music of the North. Mm. So we're delighted, and it's great. It comes up as all this kind of when people are seeking unusual Enya tracks, it comes up.
Yeah, of course. Enya's a very interesting person career-wise. I don't have any knowledge of her personally. But it feels so enigmatic, like, you know, someone so popular, so famous, so influential, sold so many animals,
albums,
etc., and yet sort of retains this borderline anonymity.
She's the luckiest. She's the luckiest musician alive. She doesn't have to tour. She's like, well, maybe she wanted to tour, but, you know, it all worked out for her. And she's a great person. Obviously, she's from the Brennan family. She's very, very musical. I have to say her melodies are very strong. And that comes from the same background as myself, in a way. It comes from the tradition. But she has, you know, brought it forward into her imagination and just created beautiful melodies and songs.
It's an amazing talent that you have in playing music, but creating music and creating staples and sounds that test the sands of time. Go back to our Japanese friends that we talked about earlier on, that you can get up on a stage yourself there and they know the music. I mean, that's global, that's international.
Yeah.
And that is the great talent from my perspective looking on.
Well, you know, I can't take credit for that. I'm bringing it through to the next generation. But you know, we are here in Ireland. We have to realize how beautiful these old melodies are. Like, I was at a festival there at the weekend, a harp festival on Critch that Stephen Ray, the fantastic actor, it was his you know, idea to start this harp festival. And, you know, we were in the church in Kincastle, and to listen to these old melodies on the harp, they're so inspirational. They give you so much sustenance, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, emotionally and spiritually and everything like that. But I left that that church the other night totally elated because of the music.
Wow.
It's like the best medicine you could get.
Isn't that wonderful? You have the extension of yourself with the fiddle.
The fiddle.
We were just talking about the wonderful airs. Would now be an appropriate time maybe to have a little interlude?
I'll just bring it up here.
We have it in you have it in a hard case. We were talking about your international travel and
I have to.
So what are you going to play for us?
No, that's a good question. Do you know what I'll play? I actually composed a tune, and it's called Angrianan, which is like the Griana Novella, which is the sundial, and it was based on a lot of tunes I put together around the COVID time, that I called Ré an Talais, which is the time of light. So I saw that time a very inspirational time, because Like, the weather was beautiful, if you remember.
That's right. That April was just stunning.
And I just felt, oh, everything stopped. Thanks be to God, because I was able to breathe again.
Yes.
And so this wee tune, it's a wee hornpipe, but I'll play it because of, and Green and Theatre down here, and the Green and Novella, you know.
Feels
so I
perfect.
Hope you like it. It's kind of half slow.
So beautiful.
Thank you,
Mairéad, it has to be said. You mentioned COVID, as horrendous as it was, and we understand that and all the mm-hmm. caveats and what have you, but there is no doubt there are groups of people that benefited, like a reset, a change of pace, a slowdown, a change of career for some. It was it for you that it gave you space, a creative space? Because as I say, I think would you be amongst those that you made the most of it?
Yeah, I was totally frightened initially. And the first thing I started to do was, I better make a will. Everyone was in that situation. So as soon as I had that done, I kind of relaxed then. And I think it's the first time I breathed properly in about 10 years, because life had been a very, very strange for years, and all I did was work, and obviously I was trying to raise a child on my own and all of this, but you know, I wasn't breathing properly. So I noticed during COVID I started to walk a lot and, you know, just totally relax. It's amazing, when you think you're relaxed, you're not relaxed at all.
Well, that's what I was going to say. There are people functioning stressed,
yes, and you don't know it.
Yeah. Did you ever find, and I do this, you know, that you don't realize that you're tightening your chest and your shoulders and your teeth, and then you go, wow, okay,
I know, that's exactly, because you know, you're working, and you say, oh, I'll sort that out later. But you know,
you think you're doing great.
Yeah. Oh, you think you're in your own head, you think. But it was a learning process as well, you know. So, yes, COVID was a reset for me. And my heart goes out to people who lost their spouses and their parents and everybody. Like, one of my neighbours passed away, and the great John Prine, whom we played for at his wedding, Fiona Prine's from Ardrah, and he died. Yeah. Because of COVID, and it, like, that blew my mind.
But it also we have developed over time a way of dealing with and processing loss, and it can be mm-hmm. through the wake, and it can be through the funeral, it can be the tea afterwards, or whatever it might be, and there's lots of people didn't get to work through that correctly because they weren't able to go to a wake or have a wake or go it to was funerals.
Just, and... yes, standing at the side of the road. It's a lonely place for the family, because all we could do was stand at the side of the road as, you know, a funeral was. That happened maybe twice or three times for me. And I just felt I wasn't there for them.
I did
properly.
Two funerals standing on the side of the road.
Yes. Yeah, it's not personal enough, and it's not what we do. It's not what we do.
But what I never, and it was only really when, you know, speaking to priests and what have you, sort of as we were coming out of it, they were telling me about how it was astonishing that people were coming to them who'd lost mums and dads who maybe had passed away in a care home setting or something.
Yeah.
And the grieving process was not normal because
there wasn't a reality.
They didn't get beside the bedside. Get the removal. And
there was no goodbyes.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And I never really thought about it like that.
Yeah.
So it's always good to
it was very, very cruel on families, I found, you know, that they were only able to communicate through windows. You know, it reminds me of Wuthering Heights, you know, that thing, the window is the between the two worlds, you know, and it'll never be reconciled, you know. And how do you fix that?
Well, hopefully, God forbid, if we ever go through anything like that again, we'll have learned those lessons. You didn't get to, you won a record deal, but you didn't get to record that record for reasons.
I don't know what happened. It was Hawk Records. So I think they went bust or something.
Okay.
But the first time I arrived in Japan, didn't one of the journalists have a copy of the actual front of the album?
Wow.
Yeah, because we had gone that far.
It just wasn't released.
It wasn't released. Wow. Yeah, so I was saying
to
the and they said, no, this collector item, you know, no Maledo.
But then, obviously, you're in Frankie's relationship developed and your career developed, and you formed a new outfit that people may have heard of then in the 80s.
Altan. So, you see, my father had Kjoltri Altan, and that's the crowd that won the Letterkenny Folk Festival, which we're very delighted. That was a good start. But when we started, my father said, just use Altan. It's an easy name. It's Gaelic. And he said, it's a local lake and it's a gorgeous word to look at. And he says, and it's an A. It's the beginning of the alphabet. You know, so he had it all thought out. He had it all thought out. So, so we decided to go with that. And, you know,
but when you were creating that, were you saying, right, we're creating something now with goals, if you know what I mean?
No goals. We just wanted to have a band. I think we were still teaching at the time, and we brought out an album on Green Linnet Records, which was an American based record company. And they wanted us to be a duet. And at that stage, Frankie said to me, wouldn't it be great if we had a band. So that's when we got Kieran Corn and Mark Kelly into the studio, and that was Altan, and it was the great Donal Lunny that produced that album in Nicky Ryan's actual studio. So Nicky was in and out, and Nicky would have a different idea of how the sound should be, and Donal wanted to changed the sound. It was really good to hear all of this happening.
But where was Frankie's role in this, with his perfectionist?
Oh yeah. Oh, he was very.
How did he fit into
he fitted in very well. Well, you know, he would know the technology of the thing, but his thing was, I hear too much breath there. You know, the flute, or I want to hear less breath.
Wow.
You know, so he was listening to stuff like that. So, you know, I think we were all learning from each other. Like Mark Kelly was into get all the chords, get all the harmony right, and that chord doesn't work, and you know, and you know, to see everyone trying to get it all together.
And you know, I just think when you're so close to the art, I wonder, do you have an awareness of it? Like, was there a point you clicked and go, you know what? And I don't mean without sort of external recognition, but internally, that you've got, we've actually hit on something here. Was there ever that sort of awareness?
No, we didn't. No, we just wanted to make something beautiful. Yeah. And I think, you know, playing the tunes, like we chose really nice Donegal stuff. And then we had a few original pieces as well. But what we wanted to do was make it as nice to the ear as possible, arrange it in a nice way. And Kieran Corn is one of the most beautiful bouzouki players because he just plays little notes over a chord. Mm. So when you hear a chord of D, he would play a filigree of D harmonies over that. So stuff like that was happening and trying to not have them blasting all the time, to start with maybe a melody and then have the backing come in to colour it and to shade it.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, it's like painting a picture, to be honest.
I just love how music is put together and yeah. Hearing. I'm not musical, but I've found myself watching an awful lot of these videos whereby, you know, songs and sounds that you've become familiar with, there happened to be a camera in the recording studio, and just the way, you know, the way you've described there, how your sound became and the subtleties and nuances, and you've got two or three perfectionists in there and outputting this. It's lovely to hear. It's amazing.
And, you know, I think part of it as well is to the restraining of not everyone in together is very important. And the other thing at the time, which really influenced me, the Cocteau Twins were very, very popular at the time. Remember the Cocteau Twins? So they used to use their own language.
Yeah.
So to me, my Gaelic was as good as that.
Of course, yeah.
So it was as contemporary. So whenever people would say, oh, you don't even know what you're singing about. And I say, I do know what I'm singing about. That's Gaelic, you know.
But it does talk to really, I mean, you know, as you say, singing in your own language, using the sounds and influence of your own little corner of the world to have confidence in it.
Yeah.
You know, that is amazing. Because I wonder how many artists would try and chase what they think people want rather than creating what they believe in and letting people find them.
Yeah, but then you're all over the shop, you know. So you have to actually zone in on what you like.
Yeah.
And you have to trust that process. And also, you have to have a little bit of confidence in what you're doing. And then maybe have the confidence, well, I don't really care if nobody else likes it, you know, because
It's a little bit arrogance as well as confidence.
Well, maybe it is.
Not arrogance in the... That word has a lot of negative connotations. Yeah. I don't mean it in that way. Yeah. I want about actually the confidence. Say, this is, you know...
You have to say, well, I really like this when I heard it. And a lot of people do like this song or do like this piece of music. And maybe somebody like it. You know?
Well, that's
what turns out. But what it did as well was showcase, you know, our songs and our tunes from this county here. And sometimes the local becomes universal, you know. It actually can be very universal.
Obviously, there was, as you say, the sound had formed and the gigs were happening. And would you say that then one of the next big things was the record deal? Because that was historic. Virgin Records in the early 90s.
Yeah, that was a shock. You know, we weren't expecting it. But our time with Green Linnet was kind of, you know, at the end, because we felt, you know, every other time, for instance, with the Island Angel, was that the one? I'm not really sure which one. But one of them got into the Billboard charts and it was number two for weeks, and we were saying, how can we get it into number one? Oh, you have to pay for that, because it was, I'm trying to remember, it was I think it was Los Lobos or one of all the guitars playing together was number one. And they said they're with the big huge company. And then Frankie said, well, we should be with a big, huge company. You know?
It was that sort of last, the last piece was the marketing. And
yes,
the
marketing, the push and all of that. And then, you know, we decided, sure, why not try it? Mm. And when Declan McColgan, he was Irish. He was one of the main guys in Virgin in London. And he contacted us and he said, really, we'd love to have Altan. And we thought it was just great fun, you know, initially going with a major record company when it really meant something as well. Like, it just broadened the whole thing. And it was like a new, this was before Riverdance even started, I think. And then with a few years later, Riverdance came on board. So Irish music was the thing that was happening in a commercial world, you know.
Obviously, the excitement of the record contract, and the joint decision and the group decision to go it forward. But this was just around the same time that you lost Frankie.
Yeah, well, Frankie was just ill, as Declan was chatting to us. And I remember at one of the meetings, Frankie was just such a businessman in a way. Well, there's a good chance you won't be talking to me all the time, but this is what I want. Okay. So he had done the deal before he got really sick. So he says, I want this deal done now, he says, because I know what I want. So there was all these clauses that we would be totally artistically in charge of our art, we'll say. And that was put into the contract because he didn't want somebody to come in and say, sing the song that wouldn't suit.
But it was part of a plan.
Oh, presence of mind in his mind. This is the plan.
I think that's lovely.
Yeah.
I don't know how romantic he was. Yeah. But for me, that just feels
oh, no, he was lovely. He was protecting me and what I mean. All of the band.
Love.
Yeah.
It's true love.
Oh, yeah. But he was very practical about it. He says, like he said, I want this contract before I get too ill. You know?
I know it was his expressed wish for you to continue with and lead Alton. Did you struggle with fulfilling that wish?
That was so hard to do. Within a month after his funeral, we had, a German tour. And my brother Garrett said, you have to do it. And I just thought, I can't do this. But do you know what? It was the best thing I could do. I had to just go in. Nobody knew what had happened, really. Mm. You know, like maybe some of the audience would have known what had happened. So I had to go on stage and, you know, put on the face and, you know, sing my songs, play my tunes. And it was a very, very, very difficult time. Very hard. Like those few years, like a month after he passed away, it was just too much, you know.
Probably too soon.
It was too soon, but it.
Just there's the keeping busy, but then there's the processing.
You have to process loss, and you have to admit where you are, and you have to admit to yourself that you're missing somebody, and you have to grieve properly.
Mm. And you have to process if. It's a positive association for you to continue to do something that you created with him without him. And if that's actually to your well-being.
In fairness, it was his wish that I'd keep going. And I think
as it turned out, it worked well and he knew you.
He knew me very well.
What age was your child at that stage?
Was he?
No, your child.
Oh,
your child?
Nia wasn't born. Then married Dermot,
Nia's Dermot's the child. We'll pick up that from there then. So afterwards.
Yeah.
So you continued on. That worked well for you. You were able to work through it and all of that type of stuff. And there was success coming, working with some of the best in the business.
Oh, it was just amazing. Like, you know, there we were playing the Hollywood Bowl 2 years in a row. The Greek Theatre in Los Angeles, you know. Playing with the likes of Ricky Skaggs or Bonnie Raitt would come and join us on stage and joined us on an album. And then we had the encounter with the lovely Dolly Parton twice. She asked us to join her.
What was that like?
She was really amazing. And she is. She's such an amazing person. My God. Like, in a way... She has come from the same background as myself, coming from, you know, very down to earth people, you wouldn't be allowed to have airs and graces. Yeah. But she loved the music, and that's her thing. And I think that's what's kept her longevity as well, because she's coming from the right place, you know.
But it seems to me the people with the longest, most successful careers you'd swear I'm rubbing shoulders with the great and the good, but no, I am no, today. Yeah. but you know, it is that sense of who you are or where you come from, and it seems once you start forgetting that, you start drifting off a little bit. Firstly, I don't think you're going to be as happy.
Yeah.
But secondly, you kind of, you know.
Well, you can't have ideas about yourself because you kind of lose your sovereignty and your identity, and I think you have to kind of be true to yourself, because really, if you're not true to yourself, there's nobody else going to stand up to you with you, and you also have to love what you're doing. You know, you have to actually genuinely.
What kept you grounded then at that time? Like, what is it? Just your attitudes, or you know, being, you know, maybe touring all over the place, but coming home and everyone treats you.
I don't know what. Like, I think it's just like we weren't kind of. We didn't let it go to our heads. You know, we got loads of money. I was able to buy a house. It was fantastic. We were able to, you know, it was one of those big deals where you were given just money and we were saying, oh, yes, that'll do. Oh, but then there was a lot of work.
Yeah, of course.
And like there was 1 year I remember just arriving home and just not wanting to see anyone for about a week, you know. And it's a lot of pressure when. And we weren't kind of in the pop field at all. We were in a kind of a, you know, left of center music. And it was huge pressure.
Yeah.
But luckily, we kept the heads and, you know, we partied a lot. But no drugs, to be honest with you. We drink a lot, but we don't do anything else. We have a great time and we still have a great time. Yeah. But we didn't let it go to our heads.
And sort of then, you know, was there a conscious decision or a time where you started sort of working with other individuals or touring and recording solo? Was there a conscious decision there for you?
No, it was just that a lot of people were saying, you know, you should bring out an album. And then I suppose it must be 20 years ago now, I brought out a solo album. That I only had 2,000
copies. I feel like your personal assistant.
I know, here. Thank you very much.
It's actually, you know, 2008, it's nearly an anniversary actually, so it's been 20 years in the year.
Yeah, I better make another one.
Yes, exactly. I think so.
No, it was great to do that because it was just soon after Dermot and I had split up. And I said, let's put the energy into something positive here rather than sitting around feeling sorry for myself. So, I made that album, and it was something to for Nia to be proud of as well, because I wrote a wee song for her on it, and it was just a lot of putting loads of energy into music, and it helped me over
it. It was cathartic.
Time. Yes, that's the word. It's cathartic.
It's kind of overworked, but I mean, you know. People do that, and I think there can be some criticism with the modern artists.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, you know, you use inspiration and wherever you get it, don't you? And
yes.
There's nothing more real than going through a traumatic life experience. So was that very traumatic for you?
Yeah, it was. You know, it's just when love falls apart, it's a terrible time. You know, there's one thing about grieving someone that's died, but when everything falls apart and you have a child, you feel you've let them down.
Everything within you wants to keep it together, yeah. But there's a reality.
Yeah, and you have to face reality and you just say, well, you know, but then I decided I'm not just going to go down with this. I'm going to do something and create something. And I was happy to do that. And it helped me gain a bit of confidence because I was so used to being in a band with five people. And now I was kind of out there and I was doing something solo, which I hadn't done for ages. And, you know, it's a bit of confidence building as well.
And a bit of artistic space and a bit of space for yourself as well.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, I was trying different things as well to what I would do in the band.
I haven't mentioned your other sister, Anna, by the way. I'm going by you. Sorry, your sister, Anna, because we mentioned Geroid and all. But Anna's a very, was very talented and involved in all that as well, I must mention.
Oh, Anna. Well, my sister, Anne, she was actually the most musical of the whole family.
Mm.
She'd be kind of at the in the kitchen, maybe she'd be making a cup of tea and I'd be learning the tune, trying to go over and over a tune. And next thing, we'd go to Hughie's that night and she'd have the tune better than me without even playing it, you know. She'd take out the whistle and she says, "This is the tune you played this morning." I said, "How did you learn that? I'm sure you'd be playing it 100 times
in the kitchen." Oh, that's so unfair.
I know, it's so unfair. And I said, "And why? Where did you learn it?" "I didn't learn it. It's in my head," she said. So she was very musical. But her talent, apparently, and it's only now after she passed away 2 years ago, that everyone's coming up. Oh, she was the best PA, you know, personal assistant for productions, for TV production,
TV film.
Yeah. They say they were loads and loads of producer directors have come up to me and said she was international. Mm. She was just so good. She was, she had a great talent.
Clearly
for
not
that.
Someone to blow her own trumpet then, obviously.
Oh, not at all. But, you know, she was in demand a lot and it was ironic, the more she was getting ill, the more work was coming in and she said, "Oh, I can't do that and I can't do this." And it's now a lot of lovely people come up to me after a show and, "Oh, I worked with your sister." Aww. Like, you
That's
know. And she was an amazing person, very strong. Actually, I've just been to her daughter's calling to the bar the other day.
Wow.
Rosha, her daughter, whom Anne would be so proud of.
Yeah.
She was called to the bar in
That's
Dublin.
Fantastic.
So she's a barrister now.
Wow.
So I think every family should have a barrister. I might need it.
I could do with one. Isn't that, it's so bittersweet for the family and for your niece.
Yeah,
because you know people would be proud, but they're not there, and it's
yeah.
It's tough,
well, she was with us somewhere. It's really funny. We came out of the courtroom, and a butterfly flew over us. So we all said, "That's Anne there."
Yeah. I believe in that stuff.
So do
I. Think when I was younger, I was more cynical, and it's not even intertwined with religion per se,
no.
But. Like, I remember when my dad died, and it was in that April, June of when we were talking about the lockdown. And there was a robin, and it came every day. Now, I know this happens, but I didn't really see it before or since. Mm-hmm. And this thing would be pecking on the window and all this manner of stuff. And I was like, you know.
That's him.
And if it isn't, it may
but you know. we see quantum healing. If you read anything about quantum science or anything like this, like, we don't know anything. In years to come, they'll say, but that was a certain science that the energy was still around. You know, energy never dies.
How could it?
You know, because...
Even a consciousness.
I love this stuff.
How could a consciousness cease?
It can't. We're all part of the same consciousness.
Yeah.
Like, we call it different words. But, like, to me, Anne has never died.
No.
She's with me all the time. Like, my father has never died. Frankie's always with me. I always feel them near me. And I don't mean person. Like, it's they're inside, you know. So, you know.
But it can be hard to talk about that to people. And I don't try and convince anyone.
Yeah, I know people.
People who view it in a different way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like... Of all the people that, you know, that I've passed, I don't feel they're gone. I feel like I haven't seen them or I don't see them.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I would not do them a disservice by thinking they're gone like that.
No,
there, because my mother, her mind was so amazing. There is no way it could just simply stop in the context of our understanding. There has to be, we're given a series of parables and teachings and stuff. I mean, it's a lot of it's not necessarily literal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But whether it's with religion or next, whether it's science, there definitely has to be a continuation. And I agree with you. I feel everyone around me is still around me.
Yes, it's one of the things that, you know, it's like all the discoveries that they have years later, you know, and it was looked upon as kind of, oh, that's pishrogs or whatever, little folk tales. But there was a lot of wisdom. People had wisdom all the time. And like the thing that I love is that thing about water and where they experimented by talking bad to one bottle of water and then praising the other bottle of water and then freezing it and putting it under a microscope. And the negative vocalization to the one was asymmetric under the microscope. And then the one that was praised and given love, it was a beautiful symmetric.
Different energy.
Yeah. So like we're all, what is it, 80% water or 70% water or maybe 90% water. But, you know, so.
On a good session, that can dilute somewhat. But
yeah. but do you know what I'm saying? Like it's always, obviously affects you. When you give a child praise, they blossom.
Yes,
yeah,
so look at the influence on us by the moon.
Yeah, that oh, but sure. This is, yes.
We could do a different podcast, I think.
I know.
But it's funny, I'm only sort of, you know, there's part of me only coming sort of to understand that. And I don't think it's far flung or fanciful. I mean, I
it's
think
not
it's,
at all.
It, you can base that. It's
just words. You know, it depends on the language. I think language is so important, and it depends on your definition of certain words, like God, like you know, or yeah. soul.
Yeah.
And that could be God, could be the consciousness that's never ending,
yeah.
and the soul can be your energy that never dies. You know, but. It might be something else for someone else.
Mm. Yeah, it's brilliant. And as I say, you know, life is very, very tough. And very sadly, you know, Mairead, interspersed between our conversations about your tours or whatever it might be, we've often had to pay respects to one of your great fellow artists that's passed away. You know, the loss of your beloved Frankie, and I've gone through my stuff.
Yeah.
Like you have, life gets very tough as you get older. You have to say goodbye to people, and you just try and deal with it the best way you can.
And it gets tougher, you know. I like, you know, my mum is in the home in Fulcara at the moment. They're so good to her, but you know, my sister passing away, my mum being ill. You know, it's just harder and harder.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is pick all the positive things.
Mm.
Look. She's been looked after so well for 24 hours every day. So I always look at that side. Anne's out of her pain. She's not in pain anymore, but she's still with me and, you know.
Yeah, and the one thing, if anyone would ask me any advice about loss and coping is, I use a phrase, it's probably the right one, but as much as you can, try and have a no-regrets relationship with someone.
That's
so,
the one.
You know, don't leave things unsaid. Don't fall out and not speak to people for eternity, unless it's completely unavoidable. Have that conversation. Tell people that you love them.
Yes.
If it's your dad and you're a fella, give him a kiss on his forehead so that you can say that you did it.
Yeah.
Whatever it might be, you know.
Or just some saying.
Exactly.
Yes.
And for most people, I think it would really help the grieving process, because the people who have regrets often, ironically, even though they're not maybe as close to the people, process the loss far more difficult,
yes.
I think, in the worst way, than the no regrets relationship.
Yeah, I think it's really important to try and live life. Like, you have to start with yourself. You have to love yourself. Because how can you love anyone else if you can't love yourself? And that's not being egocentric at all. You have to say, thank God I'm here, I'm able to breathe, I can walk. You know, and I think if you can do that, you can give that. And then when you can give that, you can spread that. Like, I mean, to live in peace in this world is what we all want. You know, the world is falling apart, but that's also a diversion. We have to kind of concentrate on what we can do in our little area here. You know, we can love ourselves. We can love our next, and then spread that as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know.
And it makes it easier. It makes everything easier if you can do that. I agree with you 100%. I mean, you've worked with so many different people in the intervening years, and yourself and your different projects, and you know, the one thing I think it's fantastic is that your amazing contribution to us as a people here in Donegal and to the country, and your contribution to music has been recognized, you know, when you're healthy and hearty and young and able to enjoy it and go, well, thank you, here's a tune. Do you know what I mean? Because so often we recognize the great people that we have retrospectively, but we've had the Donegal Person of the Year, of course,
yeah,
and
had great nights there.
Yes, of course, but the Your Night and TG Cahir recognized you, and
Do you enjoy that? Because I speak to people and they go, "Oh, I hate it. It's my worst nightmare." But
no, I love the Donegal night. Donegal Person of the Year night. The only thing that annoyed me was Nia wouldn't walk in with me with the.
Oh.
She was frightened of the pipes.
Right.
She said, "I'm not going in beside you." So she went over with my friends. So like, but and then the TG Cahir. I was under pressure the TG Cahir night, so I couldn't actually play properly because there was a lot of just pressure on me. But I'm so thankful.
Now
that
was predated. That was 2018, wasn't it? That's about 8 years.
Don't ask
it
me.
Is. Trust me.
That numbers and me and years and no, it's all fine. A distance.
Yeah. So that was nice, but you just weren't in the space to take it all in.
I was just totally under pressure, and then I think we really enjoyed the day we had here at the Donegal County Council offices, where we were lucky to that. Vincey Campbell and Jimmy Campbell were still alive and they came down and played party music. And, you know, it was just such a lovely thing to me. By giving Altan recognition, they were giving all the musicians in Donegal recognition because, you know, keeping their music alive and the music of Con Cassidy and James Byrne and all these people who have gone, you know, their lives will never be forgotten while we play their tunes, you know.
Yeah.
And we're playing very soon at the Francie Jarrig weekend down in Kilcar. So that we're looking forward to going down there and just praising these people and bringing them with us on our tours.
Yes.
You know, so.
It seems to be a vein whereby, of course, you recognise your influences, maybe those that, you know, influenced you. But there's this amazing thing too where you particularly, but lots of people in the music industry are trying to pass it forward to support young people, to put in frameworks where it supports them, but even on a personal level. Why is that? I mean, it's obviously the people you're investing in as well, but it must also be a love of the music and tradition to, I suppose in a way you're handing the baton.
Yeah,
You've still got a tight grip of it, right?
But
I'm just saying they can tickle the end of it until such time as you're...
No, but I think that's what it's all about. You can't... See, this is where you have to forget who you are and you're just part of the whole process. And maybe in the... You know, you carry what Francie gave me, what I got from all the older musicians and give them to Nia and to all the young musicians. And that's the process. Wouldn't it be awful if you kept it all to yourself?
Should people can be gatekeepers. I think that's the phrase they use nowadays. So.
Well, I don't know why they would do that. Because if you let it go to somebody else, they will better it and they will make it something new and it'll breathe air into it and new life.
And you, of course, avail of the online side of things as well. You can engage with people that way.
Yes, I put up these lessons online with the fiddlers who just want to learn. And luckily Garage had this video kind of, he has a video business since he retired. So he just put up a few videos and I was able to kind of teach people. So there's people from Korea and Japan and West Coast America. So they're all pre-recorded and all you have to do is click in and you can slow it down.
What do you do with the cats? Because
the cat, that cat. I was on a Zoom last week.
So I know him. This is how I know about the cat.
The cat comes across and shows her ass.
Yeah, she's not shy.
That's she thinks when I'm talking to the computer that she has to be part of it.
She has to be part of it. She likes the spotlight.
Sometimes she walks across the keyboard and it's gone.
I love it.
I have to redo it again. She feels like I didn't want a cat. I didn't want a dog. The child wanted it both. So I would give her, if you do well at school this year, you know, your week exam this year. So she got a dog and she got a cat. And who was looking after everything? Then she was looking for a horse. So that was
it's
the
getting
end.
Here
no, I said, and who'll be looking after the horse? And then my excuse to her was, where will we bring the horse when I'm away and I have to send you over to Granny's? And the horse will come with me to Granny's. And I could just imagine my mother out trying to rub down the horse in the morning and feed the horse.
I love it.
And I said, oh, so I had to, I wasn't the animal person in our house at all. But Nia loves animals. But the wee dog passed away, which is really, we had two dogs, but they passed away.
Terrible pull that, isn't it? It's astonishing. Yeah. It's not really, but I suppose for the people who don't have pets, and I don't have pets, but I do have an understanding of the loss because I've been around people that
it's a
real loss. Like, yeah.
Like the pets become my, like they think I'm the mommy,
yeah,
which I am. And they become so close to me and depend on me, hence the cat taking over my Zoom chats. But, you know, I just said to Nia then, I'm not getting another dog because the two died. And I said, we have to think of the welfare of the animal here. So if she wants an animal, she can.
She hasn't broke you down yet.
No. But if she wants, she'll have to look after the animal herself.
You're so busy in everything that you do that, you know, there's so much yet. You could do whatever you like or whatever you wanted to do, right? Is there boxes yet to be ticked? Like, I mean, I'm on about even, you know, the creation of music or I know you're flat out and all that type of stuff, but I'm just trying to see, is there something you're going, well, you know what, actually, I'm going to do that or I might do that in 2028 or 29 or whatever.
No, I do paint a bit and I haven't done that in ages because it takes up a lot of time.
Of course,
and
yeah.
It takes up the same time that I need. And I also want to write more music and, you know, I also loved acting when I was acting. Mm. So I would mind doing a bit of that. But any time I've been asked to do anything small like that, you know, small part, I was always away.
Yes, but then maybe a big decision needs to be made. And you had the great reset, the great space of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, is it time that you cleared your calendar and says, right, this year, this 2 years is for me and what I want to do. It is the acting.
Artistry. I might do that at some stage, but you know.
You're never going to be, unless you do it, you're never going to be quiet enough to facilitate it. That's.
Well, you see, I now manage the band, so they're all depending on me for their livelihood. So I love doing that too, because, you know, then I can make sure everybody's happy with the times that I'm choosing for them to go on tour.
Yeah. But now, there is a whole host of amazing dates coming up this summer. Now, because this is the nature of a podcast, someone might be listening to this in 2030. So I'm going to mention the dates and all that kind of stuff on the live show, but also list them in the notes of this podcast. So if people are listening to this as it releases, it's all there and ready to go. But suffice to say, Donegal, the United States, Belfast, Michigan again in the States, Finland, and TBAs as well. I mean, this is
Japan.
This is this year, isn't it?
In Japan in December.
Yeah, and we recorded a bit at the before the we had a slight technical issue about Japan, and I just want to tease out, just mention Japan one more time because you were telling me about this amazing relationship with the Japanese people and how attentive they are and how much they love your music, and it's astonishing the international reach of your music in all different cultures and continents.
It really shows you how rich our culture is, that the likes of ourselves who play Donegal music, you know, very kind of old tunes and then some of our own tunes, and that we can go as far as Tokyo and fill a 2,000-seater. Or I remember one time we did an outdoor gig with 7,000 people, something we couldn't really do in Dublin. But there is a love of Irishness and what is Irish and what is a broad spectrum of what is Irish. You know, the writers, they love the writers. They love the Book of Kells, the whole idea of the Book of Kells. They love anything to do with the language as well. And therefore, the music's part of all of that.
Yes, but you also recounted a story too, though, of you performing and in Irish, and of course their primary language, Japanese, and the emotion of the audience that you could see. I love it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, they they seem to really, if you kind of explain to them, this is a love song and your man's brokenhearted, which is most of the love songs, somebody's left brokenhearted. And next thing, I remember the first time I ever sang in Tokyo, and the first, the front row, after singing Bridge Ognuelo, which is a gorgeous song, they were crying. There was about three or four people crying in front of me. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't get, like, I didn't know where to look. I was so, like, they really took it to heart.
That sounds brilliant. And the people of Japan will be able to enjoy this beautiful music in December, which is a lovely thing to look forward to. Another thing, and we're wrapping up now in a second, but I think it's, I don't think our artists get enough credit for being the real Ireland when people come here, because that's what they want to see. You know, I don't want to go, let's use Japan. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go to Japan and go and shop at Marks and Spencer's. No harm to Marks and Spencer's. I want to feel a sense of their culture and what's real about it. But also in inward tourism, you, I know the Henry Girls and others, and there's the guided tour of Ireland in November. But maybe they do. Do you artists get enough support and credit for the diplomacy and the spreading of everything that's good about our country, but also the inward traffic, because people want to, that person in the front of that row of that would love to go and stand close to where that music was created, you know?
Yes, a lot of them do come to Ireland because they want to go to where my father wrote Glan Tan Loscador. Where is Glan Tan Loscador? And I met people who actually he mentions, you know, Lochaltan, he mentions Glan Doin and all of this. And they actually walked to all the areas that he mentioned in the song, just like a pilgrimage. This is a family in Massachusetts. And I was just thinking, that's mad,
yeah,
you know.
It is.
But it's lovely.
Yeah.
And there was one time I went to Osaka. The first time I ever went to Osaka, we were in an Irish bar owned by a Japanese man. And a girl stood up and she said, I want to sing you your father's song.
Oh, no.
And she sang it in perfect, you know, Gaelic.
Dialect and
everything.
Yeah, the
dialect was perfect. So, like, that's how they take things on. With their full hearts, you know.
And there's just little pockets, like, you know, a lot of the musicians from this part of the world do amazing in the Netherlands and Germany.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know.
We're just back from Austria last December, and we did a full month in Austria. Now, a lot of credit has to go to the promoter there. And I know the Henry Girls do it as well there. Every gig sold out.
Wow.
For a full month.
Fantastic. Listen, Mairead, will you treat us to one more tune to play out?
I will, surely.
We've taken up so much of your time, and we really, really, really do appreciate it. Now, as Mairead sets up, just to remind you that if you are listening to this in July of 2026, that Mairead is touring. It is with Altan. It's an Altan tour, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Altan tour. And we'll have all of the details in the descriptions of this podcast as well. So, Mairead, we'll play out with you once again. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Okay. Thanks, Greg. Thank you.